welcome to this episode of House of Comments. My name's Emma Burnell and I'm a political journalist. And I'm delighted today to be joined, as always, by Mark Thompson, a political commentator. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Emma.
And we've got a wonderful guest today, which is Hugo Sugg. Hugo was an independent candidate in Hackney South and Shoreditch in the 2017 election, but has since joined the Conservative Party. Hello, Hugo.
Hi, Emma.
Thank you both so much for joining me. So we are all talking online from different parts of the country. But obviously, if we had travelled to be together, it might have been harder. We might have had to have crossed various barriers. And that's a discussion topic we're opening with this week. We've had a lot of discussion and some political movement, at least within parties, on the customs union. Labour have now decided to adopt a customs union, not the customs union. I'm still unsure about my pronouns on so many things. But it's been quite a movement from the Labour Party on that issue. Theresa May has not accepted that as a stance. And Boris Johnson has rather bizarrely compared it to the congestion charge. Hugo, where do you stand? I think listeners are more than aware of where Mark and I stand on Brexit, but we don't know where you're coming from. So tell us where you come from on these issues.
Okay. So I was in the referendum. I was a staunch Remainer. You couldn't get me any further Remain if you tried. And then the Leave result happened. I was very much Remain after as well. And then I stood in the election, general election, and had debates with friends and political allies and political enemies. And it's brought me fence sitting. So I can kind of see both sides.
Okay.
I can see the...
So I think you're probably roughly where Nick, who is usually our house Tory, as it were, is. So had been a Remain campaigner, but can see where his party is coming from.
Yeah, definitely. And kind of I had only one tunnel vision view of the EU and what Remain would mean and what Leave would mean. And so I only had one side, and then since the election I've kind of been opened up to both sides, which has been quite nice because it's enabled me to formulate a more balanced opinion. My thoughts on this week's topic and all the debate at the moment is a customs union strikes me as a slight betrayal to the British public and why they voted to leave the EU. And we know from government and the EU, to properly cut away from the EU, you need to leave the single market and the customs union. And I think having a customs union is one, a little bit cheeky of us, and no one else has got that, I don't think. And two, it's slightly betrayal of the vote on the 23rd of June last 2016. So, yeah, I don't like this movement that's done by Labour this week. I'm very much a let's leave, let's negotiate our own trade deals. That could be inside Europe, that can be outside Europe. But the customs union seems a little too soft for me, and that's coming from a fence sitter.
Mark, what's your take on particularly the politics of what Labour has done?
Where are we on swearing on this podcast now, by the way?
Oh, we're totally fine with it.
Right, okay, because it's an absolute clusterfuck, isn't it? Let's be honest. I mean, it's pretty clear that we're not going to be able to get an answer to the riddle of how do you solve a problem like the Irish border,
yeah,
when you've got two fundamentally incompatible things. We want to maintain frictionless trade with the EU, but at the same time, we want to leave the single market and the customs union, and we don't want a hard border in Ireland. And these things are just fundamentally incompatible with each other. And what I find quite sinister about what's starting to happen is that we're starting to see scapegoating of people and institutions, and you can start to see that the EU is being blamed for certain things, and they're being accused of trying to annex Northern Ireland, as if the EU hasn't got anything better to do than try and annex territory from the United Kingdom, as if that's what they're trying to do. That's just preposterous. But you can already see how this is being set up, so that as and when the whole thing collapses, the EU will be blamed. I suspect quite a lot of people who voted Leave will probably accept that argument. And that's why I find this quite sinister, because I think we're starting to see echoes of the sort of thing we've seen in the United States. I mean, Trump is an absolute master of scapegoating and othering. And we're seeing that happening here now. And I guess I fear that if and when, let's be honest, it's going to be when in some form, this goes pretty badly wrong. And we end up in a situation where the economy takes a dive and we can't get the kind of trade deals that we've been promised that we would be able to get. And we start to find that shipments are being held up at various border points between ourselves and the EU. The people whose fault it is are going to probably escape most of the blame. And people whose fault it isn't, who've just tried their best to try and resolve this problem, will be the ones that get all the blame. I really wonder how history is going to judge this period in 50 years' time, because it'd be fascinating to see whether people of my persuasion will turn out to be vindicated. I can certainly imagine that in 30 years' time, let's say, the country will be doing quite well outside of the EU. I could certainly imagine that, and I will concede that. But to get to that point during the period of my life when I need to be earning good money to be able to retire, it's just come at the worst possible time for me and people like me in the early to mid 40s, because we're probably going to have 15 to 20 years of chaos before we get to anything approaching a kind of established norm again. And what I find most strange about this, I'd be interested in Hugo's view on this is the precise opposite of what the Conservative Party is supposed to be about. The Conservative Party is supposed to be about stability and things not changing and, you know, keeping things on an even keel. And yet they're going hell for leather towards something that is just plunging us into a complete abyss of the unknown, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things, I've been thinking about this a lot recently, is that the right have become much more revolutionary rather than reactionary. Rather than sort of staid conservatism, it's been very much sort of extreme revolution, change it all, throw it. And this is, as always, is much more emphasised in the States, but is being imported over here. And that's what the Brexiteer right are very, you know, the buccaneering Brexiteers are kind of sort of quite happy to throw everything in the air and see what lands, which is not the conservative, principles that I was always led to believe were sort of the core of the Conservative Party.
Yeah, but it's like Brexit trumps everything else. And, you know, as long as they can get their precious, they don't really care what else falls by the wayside. That's what it seems to be like to me.
Sorry, I would disagree with that, because I think in the first kind of 6-7 years of the Conservative-led governments / majority governments since 2010, we've got to fix the economy, And then from kind of the 7-year point, so last year, we kind of, now our economy is better, and I use that term loosely. Now our economy is better, you're starting to see what the Conservative Party would have liked to do kind of 7 years ago, perhaps. We're starting to see, I mean, Michael Gove has had a personality transformation. I mean, what he is completely leading on environment. He was in justice, he kind of messed that up. He was in education, he messed that up. In environment, he is leading the Conservative Party quite well. And so I think, and homelessness is a huge priority now for the Conservative Party, along with social care, although they don't know what they're doing, but they want it to be a priority. And so I think leaving the EU has taken up a lot of work and will take up a lot of work, because it's the biggest kind of mandate. But it's interesting you were saying about conservative values, because I I think if we go back to David Cameron and when he tried to negotiate before the referendum, when he tried to negotiate a different deal with Europe, it was very much kind of reactionary. It wasn't very revolutionary. It was kind of going there with a tail in between the legs going, okay, we don't quite like this. Can we have a change? And then the EU referendum happened. And I think the seismic shockwaves of that, along with Nigel Farage, has made the Conservative Party kind of shift into this revolutionary phase that you talked about, Emma. And I think it's at odds with each other. And I mean, I've been to a few Tory events. We had an event where they post-mortem the election, and it was really interesting because you suddenly saw the huge divide between, you know, Scotland and London and then the rest of the UK, Brexit debate, the kind of social issue debate. All of them were just really separated from each other. And so the Conservative Party doesn't quite know what it's doing, because you've got kind of Jacob Rees-Mogg and his, is it ERG, group, who is kind of keeping Theresa May on her toes, because that's 60 MPs who can get her out. And if we get Theresa May out, and there isn't a leadership election with a good contender to take over, that's probably heading to a general election, which then heads into another general election during the negotiations, which completely messes up the timeline of leaving the EU. So it's a really interesting time at the moment. And I think the Conservative Party are kind of in this really difficult position where they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. And Mark, I agree, it's a complete clusterfuck.
One of the interesting problems, and I have to say this isn't my original observation, but it is something I've heard from a number of other places, is that the way that Tory MPs talk about Brexit is as if Brexit ends at the end of the Article 50 period. As if, you know, all you have to do is get through Brexit and that. But, you know, as
if it's an event rather than an ongoing
exactly.
process.
Exactly. And I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding, both of what caused Brexit, what brought us to the point where that vote happened, about how close that vote was and how divided we are as a country, how divided all the political parties are on Brexit or on other things. And, you know, I don't think Brexit will not be a live issue in my lifetime. I think it will. The repercussions, the ripples that come out from this moment going forward will last far, far longer than anyone is taking seriously at the moment.
I think that's right, Emma, but I think we might have touched upon this in a previous episode. I think I sort of disagree with how much effect those ripples will continue to have. I think ripple is actually quite a good analogy, because I think you will see the kind of effect that you do see in a lake, in that the initial ripples are big, but they'll just get weaker and weaker as we move through it. I, for example, don't think there's going to be a huge groundswell of opinion that wants to rejoin the EU once we've left. I can't really see that happening. I think most people are willing to just go along with the status quo. And once the status quo is we're not in the EU anymore, I think most people, the majority of people, we'll want to just make the best of wherever we are and won't have the stomach for the fight of trying to get back in again, not least because it's probably impractical to expect us to be able to rejoin again. So I think that's probably where me and you differ on this.
I don't know that it's going to be Brexit as the fundamental, are we in or out of the EU? But I think the divisions, the deeper, more emotive divisions that it has shown up in our country are not going anywhere. I think that the open versus closed argument is going to be absolutely key for over the next 20 years. I think that however you define that, whether in the issues of the day, that has been a sore that has been opened up by Brexit. And this is what I mean. You won't necessarily say in 10 years' time, this is a direct result of our leaving the EU. What you will say is, I think this country is less open than it used to be. I think this country is less affluent than it used to be. I think this country is less engaged with our nearest neighbours than it used to be. I think this, or you might say in the other word, I think this country is better off going it alone. Mm-hmm. These are the positions that have been entrenched, whether you call that Brexit or not, whether the groundswell that brings up is rejoining the EU, it is these divisions that have been formalised through the Brexit process into our now very divided country that I think will have repercussions for quite possibly a century to come.
I think, though, that you're filtering that through a fairly binary prism. That people who voted Remain have a certain mindset and people who voted Leave have another mindset. And that's not really my lived experience. The people I know who voted Remain and people I know who voted Leave, I'm friends with people who voted Remain and friends with people who voted Leave. In fact, my best friend voted Leave. I don't think I've ever really discussed it with him. We discussed plenty of other stuff. I've spoken to him many, many, many times over the last year and a half since the vote. He did tell me at the time why he voted Leave. It was a fairly marginal decision for him. He did have his reasons. I think he just voted and he hasn't really thought much more about it. I think that's far more typical of people's approach to this. And in terms of the mindset that might have engendered people's decisions about how they voted, I think there are kind of extreme fringes on both sides who will have been motivated by either some of the ideas that we've talked about many times on this podcast before, and some of the motivations, some of which will have been what I would consider positive, some of which will have been what I consider negative. I think most people are a mixture of all of those things. I think quite a lot of people probably did feel that immigration had got too much in this country. And despite the fact that whatever the statistics might say, and I believe the statistics, I believe that immigration is good for the economy, but I've never really personally been affected. I've never lived in an area that's had very, very high levels of immigration that might have affected my life in a negative way. So I kind of feel a little bit unqualified to comment on that side of it and that aspect of it. You know, I think lots of people probably do like the idea that, you know, there are relatively open borders between ourselves and the EU, that you can pass more freely between one and the other at the moment, and maybe that's going away. And I suspect even lots of people who voted Leave might regret that, but I guess on balance they probably feel it's worth it for what we're going to gain. I think there's a lot more of a mixed message that you're probably going to get from lots of people than this idea that there's a very clear dividing line now that's going to engender a kind of culture war that's going to go on for the next two or three decades. I don't really see it like that. I don't think we're anywhere near as badly divided as the United States, for example.
Oh, I think you're wrong, frankly. And I think the clearest dividing line is generational. Hugo, you are our token young person today.
Oh, I'm pleased 27 is classed as young still.
It is on this podcast, mate.
I agree with Emma, because I think if we look at the makeup of both the electorate of the 2017 general election, for example, and also the Scottish independence referendum and the EU referendum, we've seen a massive upsurge of young people. And I think they are suddenly politically engaged in debate. And I mean, you could argue, where are they sitting? Are they sitting on the Tory side? Are they sitting on Labour? You can argue that's a different discussion. But the youth are a lot more engaged in politics over the last couple of years than 2010 general election, 2005, 2001. They are a lot more engaged. And I think as the decades go on, I think, Emma, you're right, I think we're going to see a generational shift. And it would be really interesting to see when I'm in my, if I live this long, 70s, 80s, it'll be really interesting to see if the young, if kind of my generation or my kind of, you know, the generation below me, believe it or not, there is one. Oh, that's scary. It'll be really interesting to see what their thoughts are, whether they actually want to do what my parents' generation wanted to do in the EU referendum, which was Leave, after they joined. And it'll be really interesting to see if they want to join after we've left.
Hugo, just to pick up on something that you said there, I think that whole youth quake thing, I think there was a small effect, but it wasn't as big as people thought at the time. I think the cephalological analysis that's been performed since has demonstrated that there was a relatively small uptick in the number of people from the younger cohorts who voted in the 2017 general election. Now, I personally think it's a great thing. I've been arguing ever since I've been engaged with politics that young people should vote, because young people get the shitty end of the stick in politics all the time. Predominantly, I think, because they don't vote. That's why you get student fees. That's why you get all these working age benefits cut for people, and yet the pensioners are all protected because the pensioners vote and the young people don't. And I think it's great, but I don't think it's as pronounced as you're implying here. I hope it does happen.
It's been questioned, that, Mark, as my understanding is that what you're quoting is the British Election Survey, and there are other people who have come back to question that, because I believe there may be different variations. So while the overall vote didn't uptick as much as it was felt, the actual influence in some seats was really quite significant, and that's why some seats changed hands.
Well, that's great news. And you know how much of a fan I am of the electoral system that allows the swing voters to affect the outcome.
Buzz!
have you just sounded the alarm?
No, sorry, we have a clap then every time Mark talks about voting reform, so that's the hence the buzzing. So having talked about young people, I think that's quite a good segue to our next topic. The Conservative Party vice chair, whose role it is to engage the youth, is a certain Mr. Ben Bradley, who I believe is now one of the most retweeted MPs on Twitter, doing so well at engaging the youth there. Sadly, the tweet that has been retweeted an almost record number of times was an apology he was forced to make for having libelled Jeremy Corbyn. As an aside, I would like to say that the lawyer that drafted that tweet and put "please retweet" at the end of it is a genius and should be negotiating our EU position.
I agree.
Ben Bradley, genius or goat? Hugo.
I think very misguided and quite naive.
Yes.
I don't know, comparing him to a farmyard animal is really...
Sorry, that was an old question that you put in the back of Empire magazine. That's why it came to me.
Emma, you can say that all you want. I don't
you
know
wouldn't
why
possibly
can,
comment.
As a paid-up member of a Tory party. I don't know. No, I mean, seriously, though, I think Ben Bradley ridiculously misjudged his tweet, and I think... It sends another lesson to everyone, not just politicians, but, you know, members of the general public, that actually on Twitter, this social media and kind of freedom of speech doesn't mean that you have freedom of conscience. And it doesn't mean that you can say what you want without any responsibility or repercussions. And I think the Ben Bradley tweet has really ignited this thought process of, oh crap, what can I put on Twitter which isn't going to be libelous to someone or something? Because actually, if you've got a crack lawyer who is really hot on it as a company, and someone slates your company a little or puts out a libelous tweet or Facebook post or whatever, suddenly you can find yourself in very, very hot water when all it was an innocent, you know, kind of comment which would, you know, gets lost, or you think gets lost in the millions of tweets sent every day, but it gets picked out and put on the front pages of newspapers. So I think he was very, very misguided and ill-judged to put it. But then I guess it's all in the action, isn't it? He can say, I'm sorry. I think it's in the action of whether he actually learns from this. And I think... it's too early to tell right now. I question his position as a Tory member. I question his position as vice chair of youth, because I think although he is youthful, although he can engage on Twitter, be it wrongly, I would question his kind of, he's got, and I heard this phrase the other day and it's brilliant, he's got his political milk teeth. He hasn't been in politics, well, for a year, let alone kind of for 10 years. And I think it was a misjudgment by Theresa May to put in as vice chair of youth, regardless of the tweet, but especially because of the tweet.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't the first time he's been caught making stupid comments, is it? There was stuff that he said before he was elected about castrating unemployed people or something like that. I can't remember the exact wording, but it was the kind of stuff that you might say as an impetuous, stupid youth, but when you've put it out there, and this is what we're all learning now, is that, you know, when you say stupid things when you're young, and this is not a party political thing, because I said exactly the same thing about Jared O'Mara, you know, this stuff gets out there, you will be judged on it. And there's going to be a whole generation who will grow up internet savvy, who will understand this. But at the moment, we're still in that time when we probably hadn't thought about it before we then went off to later become politically active, politically engaged, politically, publicly political. But, you know, I agree. I think Ben Bradlee is a bad advertisement for young Toryism, because it's exactly the image that came with the sort of the hard headbangers from the 80s, when the Tory students had to be disbanded because they got so out of control. And it's just like, guys, that, you know, have a youth wing that doesn't do that, for God's sake. And <you're, laughs> the same thing with the Mark Clark stuff a couple of years ago. And it's just like, look, I meet lovely young Tories like yourself, Hugo, and Chloe, who we've had on the podcast before. You know, why can't you just find a way to showcase those guys, you know?
I mean, I said this to Ben. I met him at an event before the tweet. And I said to him, Ben, I'm a qualified youth worker. I did my degree in youth work. I'm a campaigner. You want to engage the youth. Well, I'm a youth worker and I'm a campaigner. Hello. And he wasn't dismissive, but it kind of went in one ear and out the other, and it really annoyed me, because it was like, oh, you're not utilizing what's around you. You're not, you know, actually you can engage people who are like me, and I'm not saying I should be in any sort of position, although I'd like to be. But there's lots of people like me who are campaigners or activists or youth workers or involved in various community groups. Use us to your advantage, rather than trying to go it alone and then find yourself tripping up.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think all parties fail on this, where there is a clique that are in charge, and it's so hard to break through that. And, you know, there's so much experience, knowledge, ability in the membership. And when this small group are hard to break into, they're just closing themselves off to the opportunities that those other people present to them. And again, you know, I found this in the Labour Party. I'm sure Mark found this when he was a Lib Dem. You know, this is too often the bad way that politics works. When it is too controlled from the centre, when it is too controlled by one faction or the other, people who've known each other for 20 years, and you just think, well, hang on. If you've all known each other for 20 years, you kind of know what each other thinks, and maybe you should talk to somebody who you don't know what they think. So I just wanted to bring Mark in here, because you're our you know, voice of freedom of speech and liberalism. What did you think of the whole way that this played out?
Yeah, I mean, I'm usually the person who kind of stands back and says, well, you know, it was probably taken out of context. Give them a break. People should have a second chance. But I think what Ben Bradlee did was, he was just very clearly trying to kind of stoke the flames of this story that was doing the rounds about Corbyn, that just was bollocks. It was just nonsense. Like, I'm not a big fan of Jeremy Corbyn, but this was just, and the problem is, because it kind of fits in with this idea that he, you know, is a commie, and, you know, he has sympathy with countries other than the UK and would like to see other countries do better than the UK. Because it kind of goes with the grain, I think it was all the more damaging. And this could actually have been really damaging. Now, as it's happened, it's really badly backfired. And I think that's really good, because maybe people who try to push this sort of message will think twice before doing it again. And I think it was pretty despicable what he did. And I agree with you, absolute genius stroke to say, please retweet. I'm just wondering, in future, when these things are being drafted, I'm sure there are going to be very long drawn out legal arguments about why putting please retweet at the bottom of a tweet and forcing people to tweet that isn't right. And maybe we won't see that happen again for that reason. Just to come to your question as well, Emma, about my experiences in the Lib Dems, two specific things sprang to mind when Hugo was just talking then about this kind of hidebound mentality that you get within parties. And actually, it's not just within parties, it's human nature. You get it in companies, you get it in public sector organizations, where people who've been around for a long time, they get used to doing things in a certain way. Two specific things I remember. One was there was a kind of working group that was put together in the Lib Dems. I was invited to go along. Well, I think I volunteered, actually, because they wanted to try and harness the skills of people who had computer programming skills within the Lib Dems in order to help with the data gathering and the software and all of that stuff. And I remember sitting in a room for a good couple of hours, and we were batting ideas back and forth, and I contributed a couple of things, loads of people did, and just heard nothing afterwards, and they just carried on doing what they'd always done and just did it their own way. And then in my local party, I lost count of the number of times that I would raise issues, because I was fairly new to politics. I'd followed politics many years, but I'd not been involved. Whereas, as you just said, these people had all known each other for 20 odd years. They all knew each other really well. And any time I contributed an idea, I would see them kind of look at each other a bit. And then one of them would say, well, we did try that and that didn't work, or that's not what we do, or that's what. And just nothing I ever suggested ever really resulted in anything. And, you know, maybe my ideas were terrible. I'm not saying they were particularly good. It was just very noticeable that they never got off the starting block.
It's really interesting that we're talking about people who have been in position for 20 years who have one mindset, because actually and I think this is another reason why it's backfired spectacularly for Ben Bradley is, and I touched on this earlier, he is very new, and Theresa May tried to get new MPs and kind of new mindsets into these vice chair positions, which has never been done before in the Tory party, to my knowledge. And it's like old mindsets and young bodies. So we had Ben Bradley, who no one really ever heard of before this position, suddenly doing what we've all discussed in the Labour Party with the Dems and the Tories, all portraying this kind of backwards mindset which just turns people off and causes controversy, even though he's not an old mindset MP. And so, yeah, I mean, it's backfired doubly for him and Theresa May, because she's tried to kind of get that image away, and it's still there.
It's reinforced it. Okay, well, Theresa May is not having a great week on this podcast, but maybe, you know, she can have a break, kick back, look at the weather, because it's been an interesting few days in this country. We're not very good at weather. We talk about it a lot, but we can't actually cope with it very well. So, of course, the second the snowflake fell, we all became snowflakes. Storm ever, Emma. Go Storm Emma, the beast from the East London, as I like to think of it. Mark, what's it like down in Devon? You've got a red warning, haven't you?
Snowy. Yeah, it's very snowy. It's great, though. I mean, this is one of the reasons I wanted to move to the country for moments like this, because we live in the middle of the country, views of fields. We've got a big field next to us, our next door neighbour owns, that we can just use whenever we want, because he's really kind. Let's just do that. So we've been out there sledging today, flying kites. My three-year-old son, for the first time, been out sledging. He loves turning the sledge over and burying his face in the snow, which we discovered today. It's great. Now, you know, we did get some pipes freeze overnight, and we didn't have running water, and we had to get some blowers out because it's an old house and there's like holes in the walls and stuff, which we discovered in a void space in the kitchen. But yeah, I love weather like this. This whole thing about like the UK doesn't cope very well with extreme cold weather like this. I mean, it's kind of fair enough. We don't get it that often. In countries that have snow like, you know, 6 months of the year, they're geared up for it. That's fine. They can spend the money. I think there are good reasons why we don't spend billions of pounds on snow defence measures, because we get, you know, snow pretty rarely. And I think that's probably fair enough. And I think most people actually quite like the idea that you can have a day or two off work or school and go out and go sledging with your friends.
Or try and skate down an Oxford Circus street in London. Ski. I don't know if you guys saw that video, but it was brilliant. The guy.
No, I missed that one. I'll have to check it out afterwards. I mean, I think, Mark, you are right to an extent. So most of us, you know, day off work, can't get in. Oh, no, I'm stuck at home. But there are obviously some very serious downsides to people who are struggling, people who are struggling with bills, or people who are in insecure housing or have no housing at all. This is, you know, a very worrying time. Hugo, I know that you do a lot of work on homelessness. Have you been sort of, do you do direct delivery work as well?
We don't at the moment.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the organisation?
Yeah, of course. So I run a campaign called, and it's going to change its name probably, it's called Hugo's Earthquake. It's been going for 2.5 years, and I set it up when I was at uni, and it was just a blog which told my experience and just tried to slide away some of the stereotypes and perceptions of homelessness. So, for example, I come from a middle class background. I'm not middle class, but I come from a background. I was homeless at 18. I was in education at the time. I didn't have a scruffy beard. I wasn't sitting on with my can of special brew, and, you know, I didn't have a dog, and I wasn't on a blanket. I was primarily sofa surfing. I spent one night on the streets, and so I was homeless for 3 months. And so what the organisation Hugo's Earthquake tries to do is banish some of those stereotypes and educate society on how best can we help the homeless. So do you give them money, do you not? And actually we are with the kind of don't give them money but sit down and have a chat with them and find out their needs, which causes some controversy. So when it comes to the weather, we don't do direct delivery work just yet, and that's because we're not an established charity. We're heading that way. But for me, it's the campaign actually talks about severe weather, hot and cold. And at the moment, obviously, it's cold, but we run a campaign called Somewhere in Summer. During the summer months and any heat wave, it says actually hot weather can be really dangerous. But sorry, going back to the snow topic, there's a lot of talk at the moment about, especially on Twitter, about Streetlink, which is a service anyone can access in England, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, where it tries to connect rough sleepers with services, and it's great. But the one downside I have, and I fully support Streetlink, the one downside I have is it can take 3 days for a referral to get through to the service. So Streetlink, you report it online or you can call in, and then it gets sent to a central hub, and then it gets sent off to the local service where that report was given. So if you're in Westminster, you report it, it gets sent to a central hub, and then it goes to the statutory services in Westminster, back in the borough or the county. But that can sometimes take time, and also these homeless people move. Rough sleepers move. They don't stay in one spot. So it's a very, very challenging time for both services, councils, and homeless people themselves. And it's a challenge where there's no real answer to it. You know, there's not really a fix to it, and I wish there was, it's tough.
Yeah, I mean, there are obviously there are things that people can do, and there are policy levers that could be pulled, but there are very complex combinations of reasons that people become particularly street homeless, and people remain street homeless for a long time. And I do Crisis at Christmas. I've done it for the last couple of years. It's one of the most fulfilling things that I've ever done. I absolutely adore it. But the thing that you are briefed on really well And the thing that you have to remember is that you're not some guardian angel who's going to swoop in and change people's lives. You know, there are services that they can access. There are good things that you can offer, and you can just have a chat with someone, which will make a difference to them. But you, in that week at crisis, you personally, as your volunteer and that homeless person, are not going to be able to turn things around like some Hollywood fairy tale. That's not how these things work. You know, it's a long, complicated process getting people off the streets. It needs more money, it needs more support, it needs a lot more work done from local government, from national government. But even then, that doesn't mean that people are difficult in and of themselves, and people have complex ranges of difficulties. So there are no one size fits all solutions. And that's something that is really, it's hard to learn as a volunteer at crisis. What you want to do is go and change people's lives. That's absolutely why you go along. But you have to recognize that that change is not going to be as simple as simplistic as you think it might be. And it might just mean that smiling at somebody and having a good laugh with them for half an hour actually is as valuable as you can be to that person in that moment.
I think one of the things that I find really frustrating about the kind of debate that we're having here is too often this sort of situation is polarized into, you know, if someone's on the streets, it's because it's their own fault, and it's really, you know, it's not that difficult, and they should just do this and they should just do that, and, you know, why can't they just sort themselves out? I think a lot of people have that view, because it's very hard for them, for people who've never been in a situation like that, to empathize and to put themselves into those shoes. When I was a student in Manchester, it was the first time I'd ever really seen homelessness, because I'd lived in a relatively small town where there weren't any homeless people on the streets, frankly. But having lived in big city, suddenly I started seeing all these people living on the streets, and I was really surprised and really shocked. And this was 20-odd years ago. And I started sitting down and talking to them, just because I was curious. I didn't know what was going on here. Why were they on the streets? And I probably seemed like some kind of hopelessly blundering, naive little kid to them. But I do remember a couple of times sitting down with one bloke who used to sit pretty much outside the BBC Manchester building, which used to be on Oxford Street. And he was fascinating. He'd led a fascinating life. And how he'd ended up on the streets was a very, very interesting story as well. And I did a little bit what you just said, Hugo. I asked him, the two times I sat down and talked to him, I said, do you want something to eat? There was a spa just opposite. And each time he said yes, and I went and got him a sandwich, and he ate it as I sat next to him. I didn't actually give him any money directly, because I have been told by other people not that you shouldn't do that. You should buy them some food or ask them what they want and get them what they want. Ever since then, no matter whenever I see a homeless person, I never judge. I never think it's their own fault, or why don't they do this, or why don't they do that. I am aware it's a very, very complicated issue. I just wish more people could understand that. I think if more people did understand that, I think maybe there wouldn't be such a political problem with it. I think there would be more money available, and I think there would just be more empathy politically for people in that situation, unlike what we have now, which is the homeless people are very much othered in our society. It's the second time I've used that word now, but I think it's appropriate.
Yeah, yeah. And I went to an event in Parliament the other week, which was for the all-party parliamentary group on ending homelessness, which, yeah, APPG homelessness. And one of the things, I met a guy from crisis there, and one of the things he said was, what we're really missing is that public perception change. You know, you've got organisations like YMCA, Centrepoint, St Mungo's, Shelter Crisis, which all do kind of frontline work, but there's not really an agency or an organisation which is trying to challenge public perceptions like you're talking about, Mark. And that's when I kind of piped in and went, That's what we do as a campaign. And one of our campaigns was called Where Is Your Next Home, which really, really brought it back home. So if you have an argument with someone, 3 weeks later, if that argument isn't rectified, that could leave you homeless. I'm not saying every argument is about to leave you homeless. If you get a red letter through the door saying you owe us money or you're behind on your mortgage payments, that can mean in a month's time, you're evicted and you're homeless. So, Where Is Your Next Home? Try to build the link between the everyday person who walks on the street, who grabs a takeaway coffee and, you know, a sandwich from Greggs or whatever, to that person who is sitting on the street on a cardboard box or whatever. Because before I was homeless, I didn't even have any connection with it. And I didn't see it. And I came from a pretty small town, but there was some homelessness, a little. I didn't see it. I didn't acknowledge it. And then it was the biggest shock in my life to suddenly be in that position, because I felt like it was a whole different planet. You know, these people had just been dropped from another planet, and I never saw it. I was completely oblivious to it, and then suddenly I was in it. So it was really interesting. But that's what Hugo's Earthquake tries to challenge, is that perception that people are invincible from homelessness, when anyone can become homeless, no matter what background, age, gender. Homelessness doesn't discriminate. It's a very ugly beast which can come up to us at any time. That's what I try and spread the reality.
Well, I think that's a really nice note to end on. I think what we're trying, and I think all agreeing on, we're agreeing horribly again, Mark. It's about changing public perception. It's about viewing other people as just human beings. And I think if there's one takeaway that we should all just make sure that we do is do something this week to just make sure, just look in someone's eyes, just smile at someone. It doesn't have to be giving money. It doesn't have to be giving things, resources that you can't spare, but everyone can spare a smile. Just treat people like a human being, and that will start to change that mentality. So I would just want to say thank you so much to Hugo for being our special guest this week.
Not to worry. Thank you for having me on. It's been great.
And thank you, as always, to Mark.
Thank you for having me.
Just to do a little plug, next week we will be releasing an interview that I've done with Joe Swinson, who is the deputy leader of the Liberal Democrats. So that will be coming out middle of next week, and it should be a really good episode. And just finally to say thank you to Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And this has been a Political Human production.